All right, y'all, you're locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I'm reviewing the All-22 from the Falcons Week 2 loss to the Los Angeles Rams, and we'll be talking about the conversation surrounding Kyle Pitts' usage and how that's overblown. I'll weigh in the Marcus Mariota versus Desmond Ridder debate and talk about why the defense struggled against the Rams.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, a.k.a. Sirius Black, a.k.a. Mr. Drew, a.k.a. your very humble host of this Locked On Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Sports Atlanta podcast family. And today's episode of Locked On Falcons is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates you want to talk to faster. Post your job for free at LinkedIn.com/LockedOnNFL. So, guys, we thank everyone that makes Locked On Falcons their first listen each and every day, Monday through Friday. Free and available, of course, on a variety of podcast platforms, including Apple, Odyssey, Google, Spotify, and YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to Locked On Falcons on YouTube, and you'll get the video version of the podcast the night before the audio drops. So today is the All-22 review. Usually I answer listener questions. I know some people submitted those questions. We'll kind of dance around some of those questions. And if I don't answer those, I'll try to answer them in the Discord, which you can find the link to in the description below. But let's jump into the conversation talking about Kyle Pitts' usage. That has been a very big topic of debate these last couple of days. And I'll just basically say up front, I think this conversation has been widely blown out of proportion. I think essentially people are nitpicking and complaining about Kyle Pitts not getting two or three more throws over the course of the first two games of the season. And I basically, my thoughts of watching the film from week two against the Rams is basically echoing the same sentiments I said in the week one All-22 review, where I think most of Kyle Pitts' issues and his lack of usage is related to his usage in the red zone. And basically, if you just add like two or so more throws in the red zone, this would be a non-issue. I know the fantasy community would not be talking about this if Kyle Pitts had gotten those red zone targets and scored. Red zone targets that were schemed for him to get in both weeks one and two. And I don't think very many Falcon fans would be complaining either had those red zone conversions been successful. I think in both games against the Saints and Rams, the Falcons were forced on a few instances to settle for field goals where they should have scored touchdowns. I think you can make a pretty compelling argument that those had a dramatic impact on the outcome of those games in these one score ball games. You know, that 4-point swing that occurs in these situations leads to that. But what's notable to me is we had an episode back in January where I talked about Kyle Pitts' red zone issues and how it was related to the idea that despite Kyle Pitts having this historic rookie season, that it still felt like there was a lot of meat left on the bone. I think that was related to the fact that he only had one touchdown as a rookie. And I devoted an entire episode talking about the red zone issues with Kyle Pitts and how he needed to be better at the catch point and how Arthur Smith really did not do a great job scheming opportunities for him in the red zone. He would run the most basic backyard plays that you would draw up when you were 8 years old playing football. And it was basically Kyle Pitts run into the end zone, turn around, and Matt Ryan will throw you the ball. And I don't think that's been the case at all this year. And that's a big reason why, for me, from a play calling standpoint, Arthur Smith kind of gets a pass from me when it comes to concerns about his play calling and its involvement in Kyle Pitts' red zone usage and usage in this offense. And, you know, I won't echo the same sentiments I said last week. Go check out last week's All-22 review to get what I was breaking down in that game. But there was another play this week against the Rams where the Falcons had an opportunity to get the ball into the end zone with Kyle Pitts, and they didn't take advantage of it. That play came in the second quarter with about 3 minutes left. The Falcons were down 14-0 at that point in time. They'd driven down the field on 10 plays. It was now third and goal from the 8-yard line. They had just completed a 7-yard pass to Drake London to get them back into scoring position after a holding call from Drew Dolman pushed them back. But that holding call from Drew Dolman came a couple of plays after a 4th-and-1 conversion for the Falcons that should have been a touchdown. right? But Marcus Mariota slipped on that play. But had he not slipped on that play, the Turf Monster had not gotten him. Parker Hesse and possibly even Drake London would have had a walk-in touchdown. So the third and goal situation shouldn't have really happened had the quarterback not done a better job. And I look at this one play, and I think the reason why the Falcons didn't score was on quarterback error. Now, on this third down play, the Falcons had Kyle Pitts lined up in the slot to the left. Brian Edwards was out wide to the left. You had Cordero Patterson also lined up in the left, kind of in the position that a flex tight end would be. You had Drake London in the right in the slot, and then you had Alameda Zacchaeus wide to his side. And the Falcons were in shotgun. They were in an empty formation. Drew Dolman snaps it. The snap comes on Mariota a little fast, and I point that out just because this particular play did not have a bad snap, but there were several plays in Mariota's defense where the timing of the play was thrown off because of bad snaps from Drew Dolman in the shotgun. But Mariota was able to handle this snap cleanly, opens up to the right side of the field where London and Zacchaeus are, right? And it looks like the Rams are in quarters coverage. I think this is a perfectly fine first read for Mariota in this instance, because if he reads that outside corner, if that outside corner carries Zacchaeus's sort of clear out vertical route, then Drake London should be open and flat. The problem happens is in Mariota's periphery, when he's opened up to the right side, in his left side, in his periphery, he sees a flash of color from Greg Gaines, who sort of crosses the face of left guard Elijah Wilkinson, who's trying to pass protect him. And that causes Mariota to sort of feel that pressure and tuck it and run, right? And then in this instance, Mariota is able to break outside the pocket to his left, breaking a would-be sack, a would-be tackle from Justin Hollins. And up to this point, I have no issue with what Mariota has done on this play, right? I think the problem only occurs right immediately after he breaks that tackle from Justin Hollins, right? And so at this point in time, he breaks that tackle, he's rolling to his left, and he looks back across the middle of the field. Now, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, because we know it's a cardinal sin for a quarterback to look, to roll to one side and throw back across his body. So I'm assuming he's looking back over the middle, not because he wants to throw it to Cordero Patterson, who's in the middle of the field, but because he's looking to try to eye the pursuit, which is Aaron Donald, who's chasing him down, is one of the people chasing him outside the pocket. So he's trying to gauge where the pursuit is coming from, because I think Mariota is looking to see if he can run this thing in from the 8-yard line. But had he not stopped and looked back, or he didn't really stop, but turned to look back over the middle of the field, instead, what he should have done, this is where the quarterback error comes on. When he's rolling left, he's now cut off that side of the field, the middle and the right side of the field. He's got to be focused. He's got to be focused on finding and locating his two receivers that are on the left side in that instance. Once he starts moving to his left and breaks that tackle from Justin Hollins, he doesn't do that, right? Because if he had done that, he would have seen a wide open Kyle Pitts in the flat, in the end zone for an easy touchdown. He just flips him the ball, does whatever he does to get him the football. It's a touchdown. Falcons score a touchdown, right? But he doesn't do that because he's looking back over the middle to see whatever he's looking for. And now I'm going to wind up putting this play up on Twitter, and you will be able to tell who watched the episode before I put this play up on Twitter. It's not up there right now on Falcons, but what you'll see is a lot of people will look at that play on Twitter, and they'll see initially when Mario is opening up on the initial part of the play, opening up to the right, they'll see Kyle Pitts open in the flat, and they'll say he should have thrown to Kyle Pitts from the get-go. No, he shouldn't have, right? The only reason that Kyle Pitts is open is because Mariota opens to the right, right? And the defender, Ernest Jones in this case, in that flat defender, doesn't cover Kyle Pitts because he's reading Mariota's eyes. Now, if Mariota had opened up to the left on the initial read, Jones would have covered Kyle Pitts, and then you would have looked at that play and said, hey, Drake London's wide open in the flat. Because that side defender would have been reading Mariota's eyes and not covered him. But as I said and explained on last week's episode, the eye in the sky sees all, but a human being can only see what they're looking at. So I don't blame Mariota for not seeing an open Kyle Pitts initially on this play. But once he breaks contain, that's when he needs to find Kyle Pitts. He doesn't do that. And what ends up happening is once he does finally locate Kyle Pitts after a second and a half, once he breaks that contain, Jalen Ramsey, who's now reading Mariota's eyes, breaks off of Brian Edwards on that vertical route and now covers Kyle Pitts underneath. And now by the time Mariota's ready to throw it with Kyle Pitts, he's covered by Jalen Ramsey. And he's forced to throw it high to try to fit the ball in there. And it goes, he throws too much, puts too much heat on it, and Kyle Pitts can't reel it in, and it goes through his hands. right? But in that instant, had he waited, had he thrown the ball a second and a half earlier when he should have, Kyle Pitts would have been wide open. And then by the time he does decide to throw to Kyle Pitts, Ramsey's come off of him, and now Bryan Edwards is open in the back of the end zone. So in that situation, you know, in these split second situations, Marcus Mariota should have made the decision to either throw it to Kyle Pitts a second earlier, or in that moment, thrown it to an open Bryan Edwards once Jalen Ramsey had come off it. He makes neither decision. And these are the split second decisions that a quarterback has to make in order to, you know, get the most out of their offense. And it's not unreasonable to expect a quarterback like Marcus Mariota to be able to make these split second decisions. And so you lose 4 points in that situation because I don't think Mariota makes the right decision in that moment once he breaks contain. And, you know, again, 4 points in a one score in a game that's decided by 4 points is significant. Now, you could also make the claim that Arthur Smith could do more to manufacture targets for Kyle Pitts, right? And as I explained last week, Kyle Pitts ran 28 routes against the Saints, was targeted 7 times. That's a target rate of 25%. By the way, Mark Andrews led the NFL among tight ends with a target rate of 24%. So really the 7 targets that Kyle Pitts got last week weren't really an issue compared to most tight ends in the league. Now, this past week against the Rams, Kyle Pitts ran 29 targets, according to Pro Football Focus, ran 29 routes, I'm sorry, and was targeted 3 times. Now, if you're looking at what the elite tight ends get, a target rate of like 21, 24%, somewhere in that range, on 29 routes runs, that would be about 6 or 7 targets in this game. Now, Pitts was officially targeted 3 times, but really technically it was 4 times because the go ball in the second quarter doesn't count on the stat sheets because it was nullified by a defensive pass interference in it. So he really got targeted 4 times. But essentially what we're basically saying, going back to the point I made originally, is we're really complaining about 2 or 3 opportunities, more targets that Kyle Pitts, quote unquote, should get, that a so-called elite tight end should get. And, you know, to me, it's not because Arthur Smith's not calling plays. It's because you can go through the film and you can find 2 or 3 more plays if you want to find opportunities where Marcus Mariota could theoretically get him the ball, including the play I just outlined, right? It's the quarterback that is the decider on who gets the football, right? More often than not. Now, sometimes the play caller does decide it, right? But most of the time, the quarterback has to decide who gets the football on any given play because he has to look at what the defense is doing. Now, sometimes the play caller can anticipate that, but ultimately that decision lies with the quarterback the majority of the time. And so saying all that, I know a lot of people will hear me say that and conclude, Aaron thinks that Marcus Mariota is a problem and we should bench him in favor of Desmond Ridder. And that's really not my conclusion at all. That may be your conclusion, but that's not my conclusion. And we'll continue this conversation and talk about what I think about this ongoing quarterback situation or quarterback controversy as we continue today's episode, guys. But before we get there, I do want to tell you about LinkedIn Jobs, right? You know, the Falcons are looking to find all the right people for them to win this fall. And maybe your small business is looking for the right people as well. And LinkedIn Jobs can make it easier for you to find those right people and who you want to talk to faster and easier for free. You can create a free job post in minutes at LinkedIn Jobs to reach the world's largest professional network of over 800 million people. LinkedIn Jobs helps you spread the word that you're hiring and gives you the simple tools like screening questions to make it easy for you to focus on the candidates with just the right skills, just the right experience, that you can quickly prioritize who you want to interview, who you want to hire. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires versus leading competitors. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the right candidates you want to talk to faster, right? All you got to do to post your job is head to LinkedIn.com/LockedOnNFL. Post your job for free at LinkedIn.com/LockedOnNFL. Terms and conditions apply. So now that we've sort of given all the people that are on Team Ridder, right, on that hill on Team Ridder, we've given them a lot of fodder for them to plant their flag firmly on, we should be starting Team Ridder, right? And if you're looking for fodder for, if you happen to be on the Team Mariota hill and you want to plant your flag there, you know, essentially the first, you know, several minutes of this episode has made me public enemy number one for a good percentage of those people. I'm sure many of those people have already turned off and sworn off this podcast, right? But here's the thing, this whole Team Mariota, Team Ridder stuff, to me, it's frankly dumb, right? In reality, Mariota is going to start this week, and because I also believe that the Falcons have a very good chance of winning this game, and I expect them to win this game, You know, I don't think they're going to make a quarterback change in week four. Now, it's possible if they lose this game against Seattle, they could, right? That conversation, we'll have to have that conversation in earnest as I discuss with Jarvis Davis on the Locked on Falcons postcast on Sunday, which you can, of course, check out on the Locked on Sports Atlanta YouTube channel. But like, I still think we're on track for that week 8, week 10, somewhere in that window that we've been talking about since May as the likely window for when Desmond Ridder will probably get his first start. You know, because I expect the Falcons to win, you know, against Seattle, potentially against the Browns, and that should buy Mariota a lot more time as the Falcons starter. But contrary to popular opinion, despite, you know, my hyperbolic rhetoric on Twitter about, you know, how Desmond Ridder is better than Lamar Jackson, all these crazy tweets that I throw out there, you know, it's Twitter, doesn't matter. I don't really have a horse in the race, guys, right? I don't really care about planting my flag on one side or the other. I, you know, frankly, at the end of the day, what it boils down to is we all have a slightly different opinion on a specific player, Mariota, Desmond Ridder in this case. And to me, wasting each other's time arguing about it online is just kind of a waste of time. Now, you're more than entitled to having an opinion on it. And again, I know because Falcon fans have been embroiled in a civil war about a former Falcons quarterback for the last couple of years, they feel compelled that they have to now, we have to continue the war, the battle on a different front now, on the Mariota Ridder front or whatever the case may be. But, you know, I just don't think it really makes a ton of sense. Now, let me be clear about this. Despite my criticism of Mariota, I don't think Mariota has been bad, right? I think his limitations have shown so far this season. But he's never really been a highly efficient, high level decision maker. And so I didn't have these expectations that he would be significantly better than what he has been, right? Mariota's game, his style of play has always been more of that gunslinger. He's going to run around and potentially make plays. Now, my biggest criticism of Mariota is related to that, because when he's been running around trying to extend plays, I think he has been a little bit too prone to tuck it and run rather than keeping his eyes downfield to look for opportunities. I think the play I outlined earlier in the red zone is a great illustration of that. And so to me, the selling point on Mariota is that you're going to get this high variance player. You're going to get a high ceiling when he's out there making, you know, extending these plays and finding opportunities to throw the ball down the field. And that's going to give you a higher ceiling on your offense, but you're also going to probably have a lower floor because you're going to have some of these question marks in terms of his decision-making and not having the quite the level of precision that you're looking for from a starting quarterback. All right. And, you know, I never expected that to be anything different, you know, despite a lot of YouTube comments over the last couple of months, you know, telling me that he's suddenly grown into a completely different type of quarterback, you know. We have, you know, maybe it's still true. Maybe he has, but we haven't seen it quite yet. Now, what I will now say when it comes to the Mariota versus Ridder controversy, that I'm much more open to the idea today than I was probably 2 weeks ago, probably certainly 2 months ago, that Ridder theoretically could give you steadier play. That the idea, the contrast between him and Mariota is theoretically, after what Ridder showed in the preseason, is that you might get a higher floor from Ridder because he's going to be a lot better going through the progressions and not bailing from clean pockets and going and playing within the structure of the offense as Arthur Smith draws it up, right? And so you may not get the, you know, before it was like, oh, he'll be a high floor, low ceiling type of guy. Well, Mariota will be more of that high ceiling, low floor type of guy. But now I'm sitting here thinking, like, maybe you'll get a higher ceiling with Ridder, you know, operating the offense than you would with Mariota if Mariota doesn't get back to more of that gunslinging mentality and being able to find those open receivers down the field once he extends plays. We'll see, right? Now, you know, I'm not necessarily clamoring for a quarterback switch anytime soon. Contrary to popular opinion, I'm willing to be patient. This has been my mantra for weeks and months now, that, you know, this is a rebuild. I don't expect the Falcons have to make a change at quarterback because they have to, like, salvage their postseason hopes. Like, you know, they're not going to make the postseason, guys. We've known that. I know some of you guys have been, a small percentage of you have been very vocally in denial about that. But, you know, and ultimately, I don't think it really matters if, you know, if, let's say, Ridder starts against the Browns, right, and starts, you know, 14 games, as opposed to, you know, what I projected going into the season, that he'll start against the Panthers in week 8 and he'll start 10 games. Like, 14 starts, 10 starts, does it really make that much of a difference? No, I don't think so, right? And I can sit here with a lot of confidence thinking and believing that Desmond Ridder will get an opportunity to play at some point this season. Right now, if we get to week 10 and you know, we're in the middle of November and Ridder's still on the bench, okay, like maybe we can actually have a conversation about, you know, how much time, going back to something Jeff Schultz said on the podcast heading into week one about, you know, how many games is Desmond Ridder need in order for this team to evaluate, right? If we get later in the season towards the end of November and we haven't seen Ridder start, then, you know, we can have that conversation in earnest. But for me, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Like, there's no reason to rush that conversation in September that is really a November conversation. Right. And part of the reason why I can be confident that eventually the Falcons will turn the keys over to Desmond Ridder, even though I do expect the Falcons to probably get their first couple of wins in the win column over the next couple of weeks, is because I know after that point, or I believe after that point, the Falcons will probably start losing games. And they're, you know, the basically thing that's going to keep Mariota starting beyond, you know, the next four or five games is going to be if the Falcons somehow manage to go on like a five game winning streak starting this week against Seattle. And I'm pretty confident that won't happen. And part of the reason why I'm confident about that is based off of what I saw on film from this Falcons defense against the Rams. And we'll talk about that coming up on today's episode, guys. But before we get there, I want to tell you about the number one source for all your pro football betting needs and sports info this season. That is, of course, betonline.net. You can find the latest football developments, game matchups, news, podcasts, including the lines on this week's games. The Falcons are 1-point underdogs against the Seattle Seahawks. Now, the thing to note is the Falcons have covered both games in weeks 1 and 2. Can they make it 3 weeks in a row on the road in Seattle? If you think so, or you don't think so, just head on over to betonline.net, your continued source for all your sports wagering information, in-game live betting, esports scores, and it's not just football, it's MLB, MMA, boxing, golf, NBA, all that and more. Head to the website to check out all the trends in action. BetOnline, where the game starts. So talking about the defense, you know, we talked about going into this Rams game, what I thought the Falcons' game plan would be to slow down this Rams offense, right? On defense, it was, we're going to play a lot of zone. We need to get pressure before. And we were hopeful, given the Rams' concerns on the offensive line, that that would be successful. I wasn't overly confident in that becoming successful, and we'll talk about that in a second. Now, the Falcons did follow that game plan. They played a lot of zone, right? Based off my charting, they played zone on about 76% of passing downs in the first half, and they basically got no pressure. I only counted one out of the 13 first half plays where they got any form of pressure. Shout out to Lorenzo Carter on that single snap right before Allen Robinson's touchdown pass catch in the first quarter. And basically, because the Falcons got zero pressure, the Rams basically picked apart their defense. That continued in the second half when the Falcons tried to change things. But, you know, I had the Rams having a 62% success rate against the Falcons zone in that first half. Matt Stafford completed 83% of his 12 passes for 100 yards against that zone. His only two misses in the first half was that sidearm throw he tried to fit into Tyler Higbee at the goal line and Casey Hayward's interception in the end zone. Right now, you look at the entire game, Stafford had 9 incompletions the entire game. 2 of those were interceptions. Great plays by the Falcons defense. Another pass breakup in the end zone that could have been an interception by A.J. Terrell as well. There was one drop from Cooper Kupp. There were 2 throwaways, and the other 3s were just throws that he missed, right? And this ultimately was why I wasn't overly optimistic about the Falcons being able to take advantage of the Rams' vulnerabilities, right? Now, Stafford is not an elite quarterback, but he is certainly of the caliber of quarterback that if we can't get pressure on him, he is absolutely going to pick this defense apart. And we saw so many good quarterbacks do that last year. And like, you know, our success defensively was basically, if we weren't going to be able to get pressure, it was going to entirely hinge on Matt Stafford having an off day. And that's kind of the same thing that we're going to see when we face guys like Tom Brady in week 5, Justin Herbert later in the season, in week 9, they're of that caliber. You know, Joe Burrow hasn't played quite to that level so far this season. We'll face the Bengals in week 7, but, you know, maybe he'll be back at that level by the time we get there. And then, you know, you can maybe put Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray in that Stafford tier, and we'll see what they can do later against this Falcons defense later in the season. So basically, you know, I'm willing to basically concede defeat against those quarterbacks, unless the Falcons, you know, get major upgrades to their pass rush. And that's part of the reason of, you know, when you've heard me, you know, wax poetic about, you know, the greatness of Will Anderson and Jalen Carter as part of the strategy, the long-term strategy. But, you know, I don't necessarily see the Falcons pass rush being magically fixed in the next couple of games before they face Tom Brady. Although, you know, Abdullah Anderson, you know, he did some good work in that game, but I'm not going to put too much hopes into that. But, you know, it goes back to a conversation we had last week, right, about the all 22. Well, that's why I kind of mentioned Jameis Winston's sort of fourth quarter switch, where in the first three quarters of the game, in part due to the pressure the Falcons were able to provide on him, Jameis Winston looked off in that game. And then things switched for him in the fourth quarter. And that's just kind of the thing with the Falcons, where, you know, in the fourth quarter with no pressure, you know, the Falcons really couldn't do anything anything to stop him. Right. And that's part of the reason why they had that fourth quarter collapse. And until we can get reliable pressure with four guys, we're always going to struggle of that caliber of quarterback. And I know Jameis Winston's not a superstar, but we know he's historically had a lot of success against the Falcons. It looks like always looks like a superstar against the Falcons for whatever reason. And the Falcons did generate more pressure in this Rams game in the second half. I charted a pressure rate of about 45% in the second half, which is a good number to hit, but it didn't really affect Stafford really at all, right? We'd hit him, we'd move him off the spot, and he'd still put those throws on the money. Now, what was notable to me watching this game was Dean Pease wasn't particularly aggressive blitzing in this game, which didn't surprise me, right? You know, on the 9 pass plays prior to the 2-minute drill in the first half of the game, Dean Pease only dialed up some form of pressure on one of those plays. And it was the touchdown throw to Allen Robinson where he beat AJ Terrell. And when you blow the coverage that bad, then, you know, no amount of pressure is going to save you, all right? No offense to AJ Terrell, you know, but, and, you know, it goes back to the reason why Dean Pease was so conservative is it goes back to something I said on the podcast many times last year, is that people are going to have to make peace with the idea that Dean Pease is going to be more of this bend but don't break style of defense, right? Which is going to lead to a lot of the zone and not necessarily throwing the house in terms of blitzes pretty consistently throughout the season. And I think the main reason, as I said last year, is because the Falcons do not have this high powered offense. And so therefore they're going to play it safe and not try to lose the game in the first quarter and let teams just basically generate these explosive plays and get up big early in games. Now, when I look at Dean Pease's game plan against the Rams, I have two main criticisms, right? And the first one is more of a nitpick, and it echoes what I basically said in my Rapid Reaction Monday, which is when the Falcons use their big nickel with three safeties instead of three corners, I think it would have been smarter to have Richie Grant play more of that slot cornerback role over Eric Harris. Harris was regularly exploited by the Rams in this game. But again, I think that's more of a nitpick than necessarily like, oh, you know, Dean Pease is terrible because he made this choice, right? I think the bigger issue I had with Dean Pease, the bigger criticism, is I didn't see Dean Pease doing as much to disguise coverage in this game as he normally does. The Falcons were a lot more static on the back end in this game than I had seen this team be throughout, you know, the other 18 games that Dean Pease is a coordinator. And to me, that led to making things a lot easier on Stafford. And that, to me, you know, was a mistake, right? Where you were already going to have a hard enough time slowing down Stafford and then basically being stacked on the back end wasn't helping things. Now, the other thing that stood out to me, which is not a criticism, you know, I expected going into this game, the Falcons were going to play a lot more cover two because that's generally what teams did against the Rams last year. But they did play a lot more cover three in this game as they did against the Saints. Now, I had assumed in week one they played a lot more cover three because they wanted to stop the run, right? They were much more concerned about the Saints rushing game because, you know, the last time they played the Saints in week 18 last year, the Saints nearly ran for 200 yards against them. And the cover three versus the cover two, one of the benefits of the pros of cover three is it's much easier to bring that extra safety in the box, in this case, Jalen Hawkins, to stack the box and get 8-man boxes to prevent teams from running. Can't really do that when you play cover two and those two safeties are posted deep. So I have some more thoughts on the decision to play more cover two and cover three, these first couple of, or decision to play more cover three than cover two, these first couple of games, but we'll sort of punt those into the future. We'll explore that at a future date when we probably get into an all 22 review in a couple of weeks. I want to collate a little bit more data before I make any broad conclusions based off of that. But going back to the earlier point I made about the upcoming Seattle game, as well as the Cleveland game being a lot more winnable for this football team, it's related to my my observations from defense, because I don't think Geno Smith or Jacoby Brissett are quarterbacks on that Matt Stafford level or what Winston was able to show in the fourth quarter in week one. Now, I haven't watched Seattle or Cleveland on film yet. Within the next 24 hours, I will watch Seattle in order to prep for tomorrow's crossover Thursday with Locked On Seahawks. But based off my preliminary research going into this game, you know, I think the key for the Falcons defense is going to be stopping the run rather than, you know, attacking the quarterback. Now, the Falcons run defense to me has not been particularly good this year, although Dean Pease insists that would insist otherwise because they were able to keep Alvin Kamara in check in week one. But I think you're going to have two relatively evenly matched teams with similar game plans, which is going to be more conservative, run heavy sort of attacks on offense. And I think that's a much favorable matchup for the Falcons defense and offense than the Rams were. And we'll just sort of have to see if the Falcons can do a better job than Seattle executing that game plan. It's going to be a hostile environment because of the crowd being on the road, all that stuff and more. But you know, I do think this is going to be a close game. It's probably going to come down to the final possession. And, you know, that was a problem for the Falcons, in week one. They didn't finish there. They collapsed. But their stronger finish last week against the Rams does give me a lot more hope that they'll be able, if it does come down to the fourth quarter, that they'll be able to find a way to pull it off. But we'll explore that more on tomorrow's Crossover Thursday with Locked On Seahawks co-host Corbin Smith. And that's what we'll do on tomorrow's episode. If you want to provide feedback on anything I discussed on today's episode, any questions you want me to answer on future episodes, and of course you can hit me up on Twitter or Facebook at Locked On Falcons. Send an email to lockedonfalcons@mail.com. Of course, you can leave a comment here on Locked On Falcons YouTube channel, and of course hit me up on the Locked On Falcons Discord, which just launched last week, and you can find a link to that in the description below. Guys, we thank you for making Locked On Falcons your first listen, and always recommend Locked On Sports Atlanta, Locked On Hawks, Locked On Braves, Locked On Bulldogs as your second listens, in addition to Peacock and Williamson, the flagship show here on the Locked On Podcast Network, covering all 32 teams all week long on all the same podcast platforms that you are checking out Locked On Falcons on, including YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. Guys, that's it. We'll be back tomorrow with a Crossover Thursday. Appreciate it. Till then.